Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
By law, 21 plus terms and conditions apply.
Welcome back to another episode of Trading Secrets. Today we are joined by former Navy SEAL, entrepreneur, New York Times best-selling author, speaker, and podcast host Robert J. O'Neill. Robert is one of the most highly decorated combat veterans of our time. He served at SEAL Team 2, SEAL Team 4, and 8 years at the legendary SEAL Team 6. Having taken part in leading over 400 combat missions around the world, he is decorated 53 times with honors. More notably, Robert took part in the rescue operation Red Wings, which extracted the lone survivor, Marcus Luttrell. He was then lead jumper for the rescue operation that saved Captain Richard Phillips and some from the Somalia pirates. And he was a team leader for Operation Neptune Spear, the mission to kill Osama bin Laden. Today, we are going to talk about his life as a Navy SEAL, his transition into corporate America, which includes becoming an author, public speaker, podcast host, and even starting his own veteran-owned cannabis company. Robert, like truly from all the guests we have, I say it a lot, you've done it all, but like you truly have done it all. Thank you for being on Trading Secrets.
Thanks, we appreciate it. I appreciate it. This is exciting.
Yeah, this is awesome. Let's go back to the early days. So, you know, you're growing up and it was in Montana,
yeah,
right?
Montana.
So you're growing up there. And I think about my early days growing up in Buffalo, New York. I grew up with Rob Gronkowski and we knew at the early day, just trust me, the same guy today.
I had so many images just then of what you guys were up to.
We had a great time. He's the same guy today that he was back then. Nothing's changed. But I say that because we knew from like literally the day he was 4 years old, we're like, this kid's going to be the guy. Like, he's going to be the guy. Also had the fortune of playing with Patrick Kane in hockey growing up. We knew he would be, and he becomes one of the best hockey players ever to exist. I'm curious, when I see everything you've done, were you that guy? Were you the guy in school and stuff? Like, oh, that's the Navy SEAL. That's the sniper.
No. I was actually the guy that when I told people I joined the Navy that they would tell me I wasn't going to make it. I think the only guy who believed in me was my dad. My family told me I'd make it, but I think behind my back, they admitted later, they weren't sure just because it was never my thing. I wasn't a tough guy. I didn't have really a killer mentality. But what I had from growing up there my dad and I played basketball quite a bit.
Yeah.
And we got really good at shooting free throws because we had a deal that when we would work out, before you leave the gym, you got to make 20 in a row. One of us has to make 20 in a row.
Okay.
And that can take 3 minutes. It can take an hour.
Okay.
But it's like start on a make 20 in a row. And the deal we had was it's 20 in a row at the beginning of the season to leave, and it's 24 steak at the Derby, which is the best steakhouse in Butte, Montana.
Okay.
But then that goes up in increments of 5. So it's always 20 to leave, then 25 is a steak. Then you make that's 30, and it goes up. And he got to the point, it was nothing for us to make 70 free throws in a row.
Yeah.
But he made 91 one day. Which was the family record for a week.
Okay.
Because a week later, I made 105.
Wow.
And what that got me though, and I didn't realize at the time, that taught me muscle memory. Do everything like you do anything. If you want to be good at something, do it 10,000 times. If you want to be great, do it 100,000 times. And so later on in life, when I became a sniper, when I became a close quarters battle instructor, everything from the squeeze, the follow through of a sniper rifle to how are you going to get to your pistol? Not necessarily pull it, shoot, but if you're wearing a jacket, like you're doing a personal protection, practice moving your jacket with your thumb. Put your thumb to your solar plexus, move it, you're right there. So the muscle memory and just the continual training, do it the same every time, you're going to learn eventually instead of the instant gratification.
So you're saying everything from being the team leader of Operation Neptune's where you kill Osama bin Laden to training to become a Navy SEAL in Hell Week, your testament is free throws.
Free throws just to get good at something. And I learned early on about short-term goals as opposed to long-term goals. And that advice came to me from an instructor because I didn't know how to swim when I joined the Navy.
Which is kind of wild.
It was a fluke. I joined because of a girl. I got dumped by a girl and it was just time to leave town. You know, everyone that age, 18, 19, you have a bad relationship.
Of course.
I got to leave town. I had two buddies I grew up with, Ben and Jim, who always wanted to be Marines. They were 2 years older. They joined the Marine Corps and every time they came home, it's a Marine, like uniform, stud, haircut, Marine. So when it was time for me to leave town, the easiest way is to join the Marine Corps. You'll be on a bus, Paris Island. It's going to suck, but it's going to be awesome.
Yeah.
I went to join the Marine Corps. The Marine recruiter was not in the office. The Navy guy was.
Mm.
And the only reason I went in there is my two Marine buddies told me a joke at the time that the Marine Corps is actually part of the Department of the Navy. It's just the men's department.
Okay.
And I walked in there. I'm like, hey, where's the Marine? If anyone would know, you would, because he's in the Navy. And he goes, why do you want the Marines? Like, I want to be a sniper. I hunt. And he said, look no further. We have snipers in the Navy. You need to be a SEAL first. No big deal. And then we'll send you to sniper school. And that was it. I, you know, didn't know how to swim, but I went to SEAL training. And the short-term, long-term goal was from an instructor. First day we were there, he said, I know you've probably read the books and seen the movies. Regardless of what you've been told, this course is not impossible. People graduate. Look at me. I'm living proof. So I will never ask you to do anything impossible, but I will make you do something very hard, followed immediately by something very hard, followed by something very hard, day after day after day, for 8 straight months. And that sounds like a lot to get from now to there. But don't think about 8 months from now. Do it like this. Wake up in the morning on time, make your bed the right way, and then brush your teeth. You just started your day with 3 wins. Pretty good. Make it to the 4 a.m. workout on time. And as I'm beating you, don't think about the pain. Concentrate on your next goal in life, which is breakfast. After breakfast, it's lunch. After lunch, your next goal is dinner. After you finish dinner, do everything you need to do to get back inside that perfectly made bed. And because you took the time for yourself in the morning to make your bed the right way, regardless of how bad today was, tomorrow's a clean slate. It's a fresh start. And what he said was, when you feel like quitting, which you will, don't quit. Never quit right now. Quit tomorrow. And if you can keep quitting tomorrow, you can do anything.
Is the idea behind that if you quit right now, this moment, that's a reaction, not a response? And if you take the time, it's then a response.
Yeah. Don't react. Do respond. A reaction is emotion. It's okay to write that nasty email. Don't hit send for 24 hours. If it still bothers you, it might be worth it.
Yeah.
But quitting right now, is pain is temporary. Pride lasts a lifetime.
Okay. Genius. And I can't wait to get into Hell Week. We will get into Hell Week. Before we do get into Hell Week, I did hear you say something, or I read something about, I believe it's called the Die Fair program.
Yes.
Is that what you signed up for? Mm-hmm. And can you tell, especially finance podcast, can you tell a little bit about compensation and then also what that program means?
Well, it sounded like a lot because it was a $2,500 bonus, which to me as a dude working at McDonald's,
huge.
That's a big paycheck.
Yeah.
I can put gas in my Buick Skylark. But it gave me, it was a guarantee. I had a buddy tell me, he went to the Army before I went to the Navy and said, get it in writing, which is great advice for anything.
Okay.
Like even if someone says, we'll do business over handshakes, like, cool, sign the paper, I'll shake your hand.
Yeah.
So he said, because he tried to be a Ranger and they didn't give it to him because he didn't sign it.
Yeah.
So the Die Fair program guaranteed me a chance to take a test to get into SEAL training.
Gotcha.
And then
not everyone's guaranteed a chance.
No.
Okay.
What the recruiter will tell you, if you believe it or not, they'll lie to you to get you in.
Interesting.
They'll tell you when you get there, you can volunteer, but you know, get it in writing.
Okay.
So that guaranteed me a shot at it. And it also gave me 5 months to prepare, which is good because I was going to college at Montana Tech. I still had my ID so I can get into the pool and try to learn how to swim real quick. So I had 5 months to learn and then I left. So that was basically it. $2,500 if you make it through.
Okay. So $2,500, are you paid at all a stipend like while you're training or going through the process?
Yeah. Well, when they start paying you at boot camp, it's not very much.
Okay.
And then SEAL training is odd though. It's not like boot camp where you're all in the same room and they wake you up every morning. It's Monday through Friday.
Okay.
And you need to be where they want you. They're not going to come get you. You better be there with a full head count, everyone there accounted for, and then ready to work on the dime.
Okay. So once you go into the SEAL training, then how long is that process?
9 months.
9 months.
But that's 9 months for the basic underwater demolition SEAL training.
Okay.
They're not really teaching you much. They're just beating you.
Okay.
It's 3 phases, all physical for the first 11 weeks. 9 weeks of diving, combat diving, open and closed circuit, and then 11 weeks of land warfare, so explosives and small arms.
Damn. Okay. In that 9 months, the percentage of people that start versus the percentage of people that complete the training, what
20%
is it?
Make it.
20%.
That's a big number. Like my class was big. We started with about 217. We graduated 33 originals.
Interesting.
And the class before me was 7.
Okay.
But now my joke with people is my class was so hard, we graduated 2 and they made us fight it out.
I like that.
So that's bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. I love it. So, 20 to 33%, if you don't make it through and you do fail out, do you have a chance to do it again?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, depending on your attitude, really. Because some guys, like the younger guys are the ones who quit because they're like, well, the fleet, because if you don't make it, you're probably going to the fleet to a ship. And it's so bad in training, you're like, well, I'll just quit and go to the fleet. How bad can that be? That's worse. people in the fleet work harder than we do because it's nonstop around the clock. Not as hard physically, but it's a really tough taxing job.
Yeah.
The older guys who come back from the fleet, they make it because they're like, I'm not going back to a ship.
Yeah, they're like, hell no.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. So
if they like you, they'll let you back.
I think there's something about Navy SEAL training that it like there's so many people, no matter who's listening to this right now, whatever job they are, they're struggling in a relationship, they're struggling financially. There's so many parallels at just a magnified level. And so I want to kind of dive into it a little bit. But when you saw the people quit, whether it was in their eyes and their physical ability, their mental ability, what was the common consistency behind the people that were quitting and the people that made it? And like, what are some pieces of advice based on the people that made it that people back home listening right now can take into their life?
Loudmouths and tough guys didn't make it.
Interesting.
And when you show up, because everyone, you know, you can never tell what anyone's feeling inside.
Yeah.
And so loudmouths you think are tough guys, but they're afraid. It's the guys that eventually made it were the guys who just kind of get it. Like, I'm going to do this, I'll do that. I might not win everything. You know, like you have the one percenters, like the LeBron James and the, you know, Michael Jordans that are just 1%, but most of the guys are just normal dudes that are going to get through it. You learn quickly that it's a mind game. If your mind quits, your body is going to follow. Once your mind goes, you're never going to talk it back in, but you can convince your body through your mind to do anything. You can stay up that extra few hours. You can do that extra work, run the extra mile. If you only keep your mind in it, you know, your body's going to get beat down, and people don't quit just because it sucks, but they quit because I'm tired of the shin splints. I'm tired of my busted knee and my broken ankle. I'm tired of the pain. I'm just one after another after another. And they're trying to see who will just keep pushing through it. It even got to a point when we were on the mountain to rescue Latrell, awake for 3 days. I remember saying to my guys, this is why training is so hard. Because if we wanted to quit right now, where are we going to go? We're in the Coringall Valley,
you're
man.
You're done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it.
Unbelievable. All right. So you go through it all. I mean, you talked real quickly. I don't want to pass this. You talked about the one percenters. When you talk about these one percenters, the Michael Jordans of LeBrons, we all know them in sports and athletes and maybe even CEOs or business leaders. We don't get to see them behind the scenes as far as the people that serve our country. Like, define the one percenter.
With us, we're work hard, play hard. Those are the dudes that can go out till midnight, one in the morning, smoke a couple cigarettes, run 5 minute miles at four. Like, that just studs. They can knock out 36 pull-ups in a row.
Okay.
They're just a 1%.
Okay.
Just studs. The guy that can, you know, that can do Muay Thai all damn day and then get on the floor and do jiu-jitsu, then do CQB for hours.
Just freaks of nature.
Yeah, the rest of us are normal dudes.
Okay.
Like I said, the guys that get it can keep a solid attitude. Don't get too emotional. Don't get too excited about anything. And even with quitting and SEAL training, get to a point where if someone's like, I'm just going to quit, it's like, I can't talk you out of it.
Yeah.
Your mind's made up and I'm not going to try.
It makes perfect sense. There's a famous, funny TikTok trend that goes viral about how often do dudes think about the Roman Empire? And most of this listening audience is female, about 75%. So they have fun with it, making jokes about it. I would also say that connects to like Hell Week. Like a lot of like my buddies and I will talk about who's the person that can make it, what does it look like, et cetera. Can the people that don't have a clue that are listening right now, they don't even know what Hell Week is. Tell them what it is and tell them like some of the biggest challenges and just paint the picture.
Well, Hell Week is, it starts on Sunday afternoon and you don't sleep until Friday afternoon, early evening. And you're in what's called a boat crew, seven dudes, and you're carrying a boat on your head everywhere you go. Big, heavy boat, and you're running together. And that's basically to teach a teamwork in a really hard way. But you're running the whole time. You run a few marathons during the week. You're wet and cold and miserable the entire time, to the point you're so saturated from salt water, sand being wet, that by Wednesday, every part of your body that's touching cloth starts to bleed. It's really weird.
Wow.
But the short-term goal is the next meal. The long-term goal for me was get it to Wednesday when the sun comes up, because hopefully I'll be so delirious, I'll just push myself through it.
Yeah.
And we decided, because you're only with seven dudes, there's a whole class there, but you're only seeing these guys.
Yeah.
And we decided, okay, if you're having a bad time, just tell one of us and maybe we're having a good time. If you're having a good time, tell one of us and maybe we're having a bad time. We'll talk our way out of it. And so you're learning to be a team. You don't go anywhere without anybody else. But on Thursday night, we were rowing around Coronado. It's called Around the World. It's a long, long row. You're rowing these boats. And we were going past North Island, which is a jet base. And I said, hey, guys, is that an aircraft carrier right in front of us? And they're like, no. I said, okay, if there's no aircraft carrier right there, I'm assuming that's not a fire-breathing dragon on the flight deck. And they go, no. And I'm like, okay, I'm having a really good time right now. So if anyone needs help, tell me and I'll carry you or whatever.
Yeah.
And followed by immediate lows. But you're learning that you can push yourself through anything. You're learning that your teammates can help you or you can help them. And it almost instills, it doesn't matter if we succeed, it doesn't matter who gets the credit. The team did it.
The sun season is finally here and on its way. And maybe your wardrobe needs a little bit of a glow up. Maybe some new shorts, maybe some new pants, shirts, tanks, bathing suits, maybe even new dresses. Whatever it might be, the answer is Quince. The best part is everything with Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find at similar brands. By working directly with top artisans, and they cut out the middleman. Quince gives you luxury without the markup. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics. I'm using it to get all new. I need like just new tank game. My tanks are like a mess. And now I feel like that's kind of the thing. People wear like different type of tanks under even dress up shirts, etc. But treat your closet to a little summer glow up with Quince. You'll just go to quince.com/tradingsecrets and you'll get free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/tradingsecrets to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/tradingsecrets for 50 to 80% off what similar brands are charging.
Was there ever a point that you almost quit?
Every day.
Really?
Yeah. It would go through my mind coming from Montana. Like they would ask me if I just got off a submarine because I don't tan. So even for me, like if there's a 4 a.m. workout, I got to be up at 3 just to put on sunscreen. Then we all got to run to the workout. And the workouts are so weird because you work out in the spot. It's an outdoor concrete slab called a grinder where you do 1,000 push-ups a day, 1,000 sit-ups a day, 1,000 flutter kicks, 500 pull-ups, but, you know, water and obstacle courses. But it's a mile from that to the chow hall. So every single day, regardless of anything, you're running 6 miles just to eat on top of the 14 miles you're running every single day. And it's one after another. They tie your hands behind your back, your feet together, throw you in the pool for an hour, teaching you what it's like to not be able to
breathe.
Wait,
what?
Yeah, it's called drown proofing.
Yeah.
I don't know who came up with that name.
Okay.
But they throw you in there and they teach you that Boyle's Law works, like compression and whatever. And if you exhale, you can sink. Go to the bottom, come up, inhale, exhale. And you're calming down. Then they have you float for 10 minutes, floating, tied up, figure it out. Then swim a couple hundred meters. Then they'll throw a mask, got to grab it with your teeth. And you don't know what you're doing, but what they're teaching you is that panicking is not going to help. So stay calm. That's it. And people freak out because you're not realizing they're watching you.
Yeah.
And if you start to drown, which happens, they'll come get you and they'll do CPR.
They're not going to let you die.
No. Yeah. But you don't know that.
But
you just got to just calm down. Like right now, if you're worried about something that your worry doesn't have anything to do with, you're wasting your energy. Mm-hmm. So just drop that bag of bricks.
It makes perfect sense.
But getting tied up in a pool is kind of like, all right, what is this? But everyone's doing it.
You heard that, and I was like, what the hell? I've heard stories about you'll have to piss on yourself. You'll have to shit your pants, like things like that.
It's a weird mind game because when you, like, you do your 2 mile ocean swim, you get dressed, you run a mile to the chow hall, and they don't, like, you can eat anything. They want you to be putting calories in your body. So, like, okay, I want 4 double cheeseburgers, but we have a 4 mile run after this. So maybe I shouldn't, but it's not uncommon to, if you got to pee, you got to pee.
Yeah, just happens.
If you got to drop a deuce, maybe go in the ocean so no one will see it. Do your 4 mile run and keep it up. But
just keep going.
Yeah, it's it's nasty, but we like training to be harder than combat because you've probably heard it before. The more you sweat in training, the less you bleed in combat. Yeah. And it's just one of those things where you'd be surprised where you can push yourself through your mind to do.
Another thing that you talked about from a mind perspective in quitting was this theory of sympathetical quitting, I think you called it.
Yeah.
And can you tell people
that goes back to the tough guy thing where he's so tough. Oh, he just quit. Shit. I'm not that tough. I better quit too.
Huh.
And you watch guys, it's not uncommon to have the loudmouth quit and 20 guys follow him.
It makes sense.
And at first you're kind of like, guys, what are you doing? Then you're like, you know what? Whatever. I don't want you in combat.
Yeah.
Because I don't need you quitting when the bullets are flying this way.
Makes perfect sense. And you think about how many people in life just look left or right to that person and then they quit in whatever it is because they see their leader, their peer pressure or something like that.
Well, it's almost too where it feels like anything violent that happens, a lot of times people just die of shame.
Yeah.
They're just afraid. It's so easy just to put your head down and let it happen.
Yeah.
Like, actively participate in saving your own life sometimes.
Unbelievable.
And it turns out, I mean, you're with your team, you're with your swim buddy, and if you're by yourself, they're going to hammer you.
Yeah.
But you learn a lot about, you know, it's a lot of internal stuff that you learn.
It is. All right. So you see the Marines with growing up. You then say, hey, I'm going to go be a Marine. You become a Navy SEAL. You get through SEAL training. Mm-hmm. You're now like at the highest point of anyone that's serving. Like, you are the guy. When you finish SEAL training, are you rewarded by the government in any other way? Obviously, pride is massive, but is there an additional compensation benefits, retirement for being at that
when you reenlist, they will offer you reenlistment up to your 16th year because at 16 they figure they got you to 20.
Okay.
So no more.
Yeah.
But they got up to I think maybe 70,000, okay, which is good for an enlisted guy. Yeah. That looks nice. I actually had a dude one time. He re-enlisted for $45,000 pre-9/11. And he said,
real quick, though, re-enlisting is like you've served your time and now you're re-enlisting for that.
I'm going to give you 4 more years.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay. And they'll give you a bonus for doing that because they want to keep you in. Because they just dumped a lot of money into you to train you.
Of course.
But I had one dude that re-enlisted for $45,000. This is before the iPhone. He goes, I got a weird thing. I'm going to put it all into Apple. We're like, you're an idiot, dude.
Stop.
Not that bad.
Oh, damn. All right. So if you're
he's over there sipping a martini in his mansion laughing at me now.
Yeah, right. But like Navy SEALs then are getting, you're technically getting paid similar to people in the Army, Marines, et cetera.
You have a base pay that every rank has.
Okay.
And then they'll pay us additional pay for diving, jumping, combat pay, hazardous duty, save pay if you get to a tier one unit, which it's good when you're there because everyone's making the same amount of money, but you don't realize that you're really, really underpaid.
Okay. Interesting. It is fascinating, but obviously so much pride, a legacy that will live on forever, quite frankly. One thing I heard you say is that snipers will kill more people. I think you said assaulters will kill more famous people. How profound is that?
It's one of those things I was saying it as a joke, and I just figured it would work because our snipers were getting some. Like when we would go, especially to Iraq, before we'd go to because you're going in urban environments, going into buildings, mm-hmm. snipers get up high and they're just looking out for you. And they always spot the bad guys, really, really good dudes. And they blast people that are trying to get us. They'd save us. Same with the Rangers. We'd always hear them go hot. You know, it's going to be a good night. Mm-hmm. But I just had that because I was a sniper going to SEAL Team 6, but I want to be in the room. I want to be on the hostage rescue. I want to go after the tier one targets. But I was even saying too, even though Delta Force is going to get Bin Laden, maybe I'll get to meet the guy because I'm an assaulter at SEAL Team 6.
Yeah.
But it's not going to be us. There's no way.
Interesting.
But if you just make yourself available, wherever you are, be there.
Yeah. And if you put yourself out there, mm-hmm. it might come to mm-hmm. fruition. You speak it into existence. Obviously, you did. We'll get into that. But you're part of SEAL Team 6, of course, the mission to kill Osama bin Laden. Before that, over 400 combats. Mm-hmm. I mean, was there anything within your legacy and length of combats that even came close to what you guys were doing as far as the bin Laden mission? And were any of them as risky as the bin Laden
mission? There were a lot more risky missions that we did.
Interesting.
And what the missions that we did before, though, it was really good. Not, I hate to say training because mm-hmm. we're in combat and we're getting in shootouts, but we were learning from it because you learn a lot more from failure than you do from success. And so we would, because a lot of our tactics, Al-Qaeda was, they would monitor and they would look us up on the internet. They would find our tactics and they would adjust to what they thought we do. We'd have to readjust. So we're constantly changing our training, making sure our guys are prepared before we go. And we learned little things like if you see movies and something happens and people start screaming, go, go, go. Yeah. And yelling, shooter, blah, blah, blah. We learned shut up. If I see you turn a corner and point up, you don't need to yell stairway. I'll assume it's either a stairway or you ran into a 14-foot terrorist.
Interesting.
And if you're putting a bomb on the door, you don't need to yell fire in the hole. I'm assuming you're going to blow it up.
Yeah.
That's it. So you might as well yell, here we are, here we come. Just shut up.
Yeah.
Keep it simple, too. Like when someone, they asked me about the bin Laden raid, some compound that big, how did 23 of you guys clear it? That's not a lot of guys. And I was like, well, if the guy in front of me went left, I went right. And we just kept doing that.
Space.
Keep it simple.
Yeah, keep it simple.
Yeah, so we would learn from it to the point where we got really good. And we would just learn from targets. And then we would always, every day I went to work at SEAL Team 6, I would wake up excited because I get to go to work with people who are better than me.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of undermining someone that's successful, I would ask them, like, if someone outshot me on a competition, I wouldn't try to cheat their score. I would say, hey, what time do you wake up and what's your workout? What do you eat in the morning? Why did you move this pouch to that side? What's your thinking process? And making the team better. You know, it's exciting. And we learn from everything.
When you're doing your work as a sniper, I have read that majority of the work is actually surveying. It's like, right, a lot of it's just surveying the area as opposed to shooting. Is that the case?
A lot of it is watching.
Watching.
It's boring.
Okay.
Before we went, like, right before 9/11, we were in Kosovo. We would do 3-day missions in the mountains, watching towns, and it's so monotonous. It's so boring. You're looking through the same scope. And that's where I learned to count. Just start counting 1 to 1,000, 1,000 to 1.
To what? Keep yourself entertained?
Just count, yeah, because you're looking, but I want to keep my mind on something.
Interesting.
Instead of just like, you know, fading out and falling asleep or whatever. And that helped. But even with snipers, a traditional sniper shot, pulling the trigger is simple. Holding it where someone tells you to hold it is simple. The spotter's got the hard job. So a spotter will lay right behind you with a spotting scope over your shoulder. And his job is to tell you where the target is, sort of guess the distance. The further you get out, your distance needs to be spot on. So whether you're lasing it or doing mil dot counts or whatever. And then the spotter can actually see the vapor trail of the bullet. So he's got to correct for the shooter.
Interesting.
So all it'll say is like, you know, 2 left, up 3. And then the sniper just holds and pulls and the spotter's got
to
be right.
And the spotter, well, just something I want to backtrack to. You said said, like, what is this guy eating and what is this guy working out? I would never connect nutrition and weightlifting to potential success of a shooter, a sniper. So, like, what are the things that go into making those people the best of the best in their business? Those people, you, like, what is
I think the nutrition is with anything. Like, you're going to, and I'm guilty, you know, instead of eating a fast food in the morning, having a protein shake or something like that. Because it's everything from with shooting, like, your heart rate might go down. What are you like? What is making you better than me? And I want to copy you. That's basically it.
And so, do you like they say the most successful CEOs in this country actually have super low cortisol levels and they're just not like impacted by stress? Do you see a connection into that?
I think so. I give myself my own advice every day.
Yeah.
And I'll flip out about the dumbest stuff. Mm-hmm. But I have to take a deep breath and a step back and realize that stress is a choice. Like, I can be stressed out or I can just not. But it takes a minute for me to do that. Like, even today with something with traffic, I'm yelling. I'm like, all right, that's not going to speed her up or speed him up or whatever. Chill out.
So, like, the concept of, like, anxiety and stress, you're just like, no, you control that.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah.
But you can also let it spin out of control. It's like panic is contagious. If someone panics, we all – like, look at – why did we run out of toilet paper in 2020?
Yeah, yeah.
It's not – toilet paper is not a survival mechanism. It's just nice to have.
Yeah,
someone bought it all. Someone else saw them, so we bought it all. And it's panic.
Yeah.
And look at an airport. If someone from Zone 5 tries to board with Zone 1, chaos.
Yeah, and it's true. That's a good point. But
you know what else is contagious that I learned is calm, because no one can tell what you're thinking. And if you could portray calm, people will see you and be calm, and that makes everyone calm.
That makes a lot of
sense. But again, like, it sounds good in theory.
Yeah.
I'll be screaming at someone today.
Yeah. Let's actually take that into practice, right? So many people here will deal with crazy days or bullshit bosses, or they get screwed over on a deal, whatever. They go nuts. They freak out. And your line of work, like, your pinnacle of what is probably the most frustrating, scary, lonely, sad, fearful is probably knowing that you're doing something that is, like, actually taking a human's life. In your mind, how do you deal with that as it connects to your career? Like, what are some of the things you do to process that?
Well, at the time, you're doing what everyone else is doing. And so if everyone's special, no one's special. When I was at SEAL Team 6, the only people I knew were SEALs, SEALs families, and bartenders. So it was
like
normal.
In your life, those are the only humans you know. Wow.
I know guys who would make headlines, not necessarily their name, but the mission they run. I know guys that would save lives. And then I'd see them in the gym. And it was just normal. So killing people was normal. The problem is later. 7-8 years later, when you're thinking, like, one of my things, there's a guy I think about every day that I killed him in his room in front of his wife, and I killed his brother in the living room. I came in there and I think about him, and I think, all right, why did I kill him? Well, he went for his gun. Why did he go for his gun? Well, because I was in his room at 2 a.m, his worst nightmare. Why was I in his room? Well, because President Bush decided he didn't like Saddam Hussein because he tried to do something to his dad, so we invaded Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And then I start thinking, well, what if I would have met that dude somewhere else, like in Paris over coffee? Was he funny? I don't know. Wow. He went for a gun. He's obviously a bad guy, but that's the stuff that goes through your head.
Sure.
And so right now, I mean, I've been to combat a ton, but I'll be the first guy to say war is not the best thing. Maybe we should take another route.
Yeah.
Because it seems like the people that want to send us to war never go to war, don't have family members to go to war, but they sure make a lot of money off of it.
And then 8 years later, when those things come to fruition, like, what are some coping mechanisms you've dealt with to help?
Well, talking with guys that were there.
Yeah.
And I like to think we never hit the wrong target. I've been fortunate because I never killed the wrong person.
Yeah.
And I mean, I know these are bad guys, but it's almost like, can we just take a second here?
Yeah.
Maybe this is something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I an asshole for being in your house right now? Maybe.
Yeah.
But at the time, it's like, we're trying to see who can get more kills.
Yeah.
We were at a point in Iraq where if we only killed 11 guys in a night, we're like, we just wasted our time. That wasn't even worth it.
Wow.
It was a lot.
What were you, like, when you were killing in Iraq, what were you looking for?
So, Al-Qaeda.
Al-Qaeda.
What Al-Qaeda was, so there's a Sunni-Shia split.
Yep.
They don't like each other.
Yep.
And Sunni is Al-Qaeda. And so the easiest place to fight Americans was in Iraq. So they come from Jordan, Egypt, anything Sunni. Sunni is the majority of Muslims.
Right.
We run into Shia too, but that's in the Shia part of town, like Muqtada al-Sadr. But what the Sunnis were doing, and this is why it's tough with the civilians, they would come into Sunni parts and make the Sunni families let them stay with them. So these are bad guys, and they're not friendly to them.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where you're dealing with the people in a combat zone that just want to get on with their lives. They deal with Al-Qaeda all day, and then they have to deal with us at night. And they got to tightrope it because they're either going to go to Abu Ghraib or they're going to get their head cut off. So what we would do is we figured out how to talk to the people. And what we learned was Don't interrogate, but talk to like the youngest kid in the house.
Huh.
Pull him aside, and with like I would keep an interpreter behind the kid.
Sure.
And I would say, who finally, like dust him off, finally the man of the house. Who are these dudes? Like, yeah. Who don't you know? I don't know those three. And like make, they can't see him. I don't know those three guys. It's like, boom, that's Al-Qaeda.
Okay, gotcha. And so and you're doing your due diligence through negotiation, which people do every day in their jobs. And your idea here is like, we're trying to separate the good from the evil so that we could take it down. And
most people are good people, seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
Al-Qaeda's, they're not good people. And these guys don't want him in there. So we figured if we can start killing Al-Qaeda, the Sunni will be on our team, which they were. And it worked during in 07. It was called the Awakening.
Right.
And we were fighting Al-Qaeda, who deserved to be fought. And we, you know, we were winning over people, too. It was something to watch.
Wow.
But, you know, again, you get politicians and lawyers involved. It gets all screwed up.
It gets all screwed up. Legendary SEAL Team 6, obviously, you are a massive part of that. But I want to ask about SEAL Team 2, SEAL Team 4. Just exactly, like, how are those teams orchestrated? Like, how, like, you hear these names, you hear these titles. Like, how is it you that gets called?
It was, again, keeping things simple. At first, there was SEAL Team 1 and SEAL Team 2. So the odd number is in Coronado, even in Virginia.
Okay.
That was the first teams. So now the even numbers are all in Virginia, 2, 4, 8, 10, 3, 1, 3, 5, 7. But when SEAL Team 6 was commissioned, that was in 1980, there was 1, 2, and then Richard Marcinko commissioned 6 because he knew the Russians would say, okay, we know about SEAL Team 1, 2, and 6. Where the hell are 3, 4, and 5?
Yeah.
Just a psychological aspect of it. Uh-huh. But 6 is the tier 1 unit, and you need to do another selection course to get there, and that is the Hostage Rescue National Mission Force. So we're going to get the hostage rescue at sea. We're going to get the bin laundry.
Listing your vacation rental on Booking.com opens the door to more guests. Booking.com is one of the most downloaded travel apps in the world. That makes it the place for you to list your vacation rental if you want to earn more with consistent bookings, reach new markets, and turn hosting into steady income. Over the past 25 years, they have helped more than 1.8 billion vacation rental guests find places to stay. So why not help them find yours? And it's not just about access to amazing guests. Booking.com also makes it easy for you to run your growing business. You could chat with guests, accept or decline bookings, and have total control over your property's calendar and finances. It's hosting on your terms. The best part? Getting started is super easy. In less than 15 minutes, you can register your property, and nearly half of the partners will get their first booking within a week. Plus, if you're already listed on another site, Booking.com makes it easy to import your property info and get going right away. Whether you're looking to earn that extra income, fill those vacant weekends, or grow your business, head over to Booking.com to see how you can get started today. The reach is global, the bookings are consistent, and the control is yours. For bookings you've always dreamed of, list your property on Booking.com.
When you get called to that team and you're looking around, any form of imposter syndrome, just saying like, why do I belong here?
You know, it was once you calm down,
yeah,
I was really worried about my sense of humor because these guys are funny.
Okay,
like I can do the physical stuff, and I'm but like even like selection is really hard, and we thought we were good. So we call it close quarters battle CQB, which is the SWAT team entrance you do, and you got to get really good at that because for us combat came down to an entry point like a door or a cave entrance, a ship hatch, and once we got through with the hardest selection course in the world, we're good.
Yeah.
And then I got to my squadron, the first run they're just gone. I'm like, the hell those guys go? They're just clearing the house without me.
Wow.
So tactic, speed, and humor.
Okay.
And the humor
The humor is interesting. You wouldn't expect that.
You can't lose your sense of humor because if morale takes a dump, the whole team's going to fall.
Yeah.
And keeping it simple, one of our mottos is nobody wants to work for a dick.
Yeah.
I had a dude tell me that nobody ever worked for me. They work with me.
Yeah.
Prime example. Because the difference between officers and enlisted, the officers are technically in charge, and the enlisted are lower, but they kind of run the team. We were in Iraq, that 07 deployment, and we would hit a house full of terrorists, but then we'd find intelligence, go to another house, follow on targets.
Okay.
Hit another one, another. Now we're sweaty, it's hot, even though it's night, and I want to hit another one. I would keep my maps like a quarterback.
Yeah.
And my boss, who's an officer, my commander, was right here, and I said, all right, here's the deal. We're in building 1-1 right now. I want to hit 2. And I go, you know what? Shit, sir, you're in charge. And he said, he's a good leader. He said, oh, make no mistake. I'm not in charge. I'm responsible. You're in charge. Don't fuck me.
Ooh.
He's like, that's a good leader right there.
God, the amount of life lessons you learn in a role.
You learn
like
in the hard way.
Like the hardest way of all ways. One thing I heard and I read about was about, and I think the exact quote you used before you got into the monologue was you said, the woman who found bin Laden told you that I don't know what's inside, but there will be a stairwell and then you're going to run into Khalid bin Laden, the one son. But before we go there, I stopped at the woman who found bin Laden.
Yeah.
How many times were you guys guys on missions, or do you know of missions that were deployed in which you thought Bin Laden was found
Zero.
And it wasn't? That was the first time.
Yeah, we thought he was a ghost. He's gone. We're never going to find him. My last deployment a few months before the Bin Laden raids ended in about February of 11, and I was actually on the base in Jalalabad, Afghanistan, the CIA base where the Bin Laden team was. I didn't even know they were there.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were tracking him, and mm-hmm. I didn't know this particular woman. Her only job in life was to find him, and she was there.
And how did she find him?
At some point, they intercepted some phone calls from one of his old couriers to his mom in Kuwait. And what they were, she asked where he was, and he said, "I'm working with the people I used to work for." And they just knew that her son was attached to Bin Laden. So this guy was so smart, he would drive around places like Karachi, Pakistan. Someone would drive, and he's on his phone, and they can't quite find him because he's moving. So they had he would make a call. They intercept. You got to find him. And we're talking in Karachi, like bazaars and people everywhere. You got to find one car. You don't know what it looks like with a guy on a phone. That's going to take years. They finally got him, and then they got to track him back where he's going. And the way they would do that is get a local and follow him to a spot where you lose him, and then keep someone there. And then if you see him again, follow him there, and then keep him there. And they did that for years until finally the guy took a right down a dead-end road. Okay, he went to that house. That's something. Now they started watching that.
Interesting.
And then they got to watch the house. And the Bin Ladens were really good at their operational security. Like they burn all their trash. They grew their own food. Nobody gets in. They called him the pacer. They would see one dude that would walk around, and the smart people would see like his shadow, and based on whatever, he's this tall, that matches. He never stops to do menial work with other people. He's really important. That's someone. It's either a major drug dealer or that's an Al-Qaeda leader. And, mm-hmm. and she was the one that knew it. And she turned out to be 100% right on every single person in that house.
Unbelievable. Yeah. When she did say that she thought he was there, did she give a percentage of likelihood?
100%.
She knew 100%.
We would finish training. Like, we would work with helicopters all day long, yeah. all night long, working our problems, working our contingencies. Then we'd go back to the hotel. Someone had made a two-scale model of his house. We'd talk about everything, keep talking. And when we were done, she would say, "Okay, guys, Osama bin Laden right now is on the third floor of this house. I don't understand why we're not going to sleep well." Hmm. Same thing every night. Yeah. "Guys, we got to go. He's going to leave."
Yeah. Some of the greatest evils that we've ever seen in the history of the world, some people also put in this classification as like genius. Would you put like a bin Laden? Would you space that? Like, he's like genius, you're saying IQ genius.
Charismatic. Millions of people loved him. Because when you go into combat, you got to figure everyone thinks they're the good guy. And so he had followers that literally would blow themselves up for him because he told them if they martyr themselves, they go to paradise. Wow. And no, but they know it. And you have to see it to believe it. I tell people, like, when you go to Thanksgiving dinner and that one crazy aunt who's completely religious and out of her mind, and she knows she's right. They're worse. They know they're right. And they're killing themselves over this.
Unbelievable.
So yeah, he was a genius.
Okay, let me get into this though with Bin Laden. So you're called to action. It's go time. You've practiced 100 times over. When you're getting ready, and I'm trying to make parallels of the craziest examples ever to exist in the world to like anybody at home that's getting ready for maybe a big day, but you're getting ready. Are you like, "Let's kill this motherfucker"? Are you like, "I might die today"? Are you like shitting your pants? Like, what is going through your brain?
There wasn't fear.
At all?
No, but we expected it to be a one-way mission.
But how do you not have fear in a moment that really creates a
lot
of fear?
It's not going to matter. The way we're going to die, we won't know, because it's a 90-minute flight in on helicopters that we don't know if they work. And we're not at war with this country. First world air defense, 90 minutes to fly in. There's going to be a gunfight as soon as we land. If anyone's going to blow his whole house up and kill everyone inside, it's Bin Laden. We're going to run out of fuel. We don't have places to refuel on the way in. So we might end up dying fighting Pakistani police. We might end up in a Pakistani prison. That'd be a slow death. We were so convinced that we weren't coming home that the guy that actually was with me on the last set of stairs wasn't planned that way. It just worked out that way. He said, "Don't take this the wrong way, because I'm going 100%. I just need to say it out loud. If we know we're going to die, why are we going?" Which is fair. And what we said to each other was, we're not going for the fame or we're never getting the reward, but we are going after Bin Laden for the first Americans to fight Al-Qaeda toe-to-toe to the death. And those were the passengers on United 93. We're going after Bin Laden for the single mom who dropped her kids off at elementary school on a beautiful Tuesday morning. And an hour later, she jumped to her death out of a skyscraper, because that's a better alternative than whatever is going on inside. And like, she looked down and made a choice and maybe grabbed a stranger's hand. And her last gesture of human decency was holding her skirt together as she killed herself. Yeah. They were never supposed to be in the fight. We're supposed to be in the fight. And that's why we're going.
Mm-hmm.
That's the conversation we had with each other.
Wow.
And it was, I mean, even before we left, it wasn't handshake. It was a hug. And like, time to go, boys.
And you, in your head, there was a big likelihood that you weren't coming
back. We're not coming back. Well, I even ran into, they called her Maya in the movie. I ran into her on the way to the helicopter, and she was outside. She came over with us. She's in Jalalabad. And she was pacing. And I said, hey, why are you nervous? And she goes, are you kidding me? Why aren't you nervous? And I said, because I do this every night, man. I fly somewhere. I fuck with people. I come home.
Yeah.
And I was walking away, and I go, of course, you need to be right on this one. So I understand why you're pacing. I'll see you in a few hours.
All right. Give me of all this experience, which is so wild, what is like one takeaway to keep your composure in times of mayhem? What is breathing, mental, telling yourself?
Get rid of the noise. You know, if you can't affect something with worrying, let it go.
Mm-hmm.
The whole what someone else says about you is none of your business.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe.
Yeah.
Slow down. Slow is smooth. Smooth is fast. If you want to be fast, slow down.
Yeah. I like that. And I think the big thing I'm taking away is like reconditioning your thinking, right? If you're thinking like, if we know we're going to die, why are we going? Just that reposition of this is why we're going.
Yeah.
Think about how your attitude shifts, your energy shifts, like every motivation shifts, just reframing.
We even had the Braveheart talk where, because we told guys, you can pull yourself off anytime.
Yeah.
You don't have to go. We have alternates.
Yeah.
And you can go and you can live for 50 years.
Yeah.
However, on your deathbed, would you give every single day for one shot at this guy?
And the
answer better be yes. And it was for everyone.
I love it.
And then going into it's like, we didn't get dressed up for nothing. Like Braveheart said, we're going to kill this guy.
Yeah, 100%. Mm-hmm. And then you do it. You guys get in there and you tell the story about how you get up there and all of a sudden you're 3 feet from Bin Laden and you're one of your SEALs says, are you good? And you're like, now what do we do?
What do we do now?
Yeah, what do we do now?
Yeah, after I shot him three times, his wife, Amal, he was like pushing her toward me.
Yeah.
And I was moving her because I was in the room alone, but I know other guys are coming in and we are the good guys. So I don't want her to get hurt. And I actually looked down and I saw his 2-year-old son, Hussein, standing there.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the humanity of it. As a father, I was thinking, this kid's got nothing to do with this.
Yeah.
So I moved them back and then I turned around. I can hear Bin Laden take his last breath. And a guy comes up to me and goes, are you good? And I said, what do we do now? And he smiled and he said, well, now we find the computers that you do this every night, hundreds of times. Come on.
Yeah, wake up.
I go, yeah, you're right. I'm back. Holy shit. And he goes, yeah, you just killed Osama bin Laden. Your life just changed. Get to work.
And it was just like instantly.
Get to work. Yeah, it pulled me back into it.
Okay.
Because we're supposed to be dead. And I was like, well, shit, now we can leave.
Once you guys were exiting, was there any risk at that point or were you guys in the clear?
A whole bunch of risk because the locals, because this is a resort town. This isn't a war zone.
Mm.
The locals were kind of coming out because we crashed a helicopter.
Yeah, yeah.
It's loud on a Sunday night. There was a dude outside tweeting about that. And the locals were, we brought a dude with us though. And no kidding, I still don't know who he was.
Yeah.
I think he was a targeting officer or something.
Okay.
But he spoke fluent Urdu.
Okay.
So he didn't know accent. And he was yelling at the people, go home. This is an ISI exercise. No big deal.
Oh, okay.
But we had to blow up a helicopter and bring another one in to get out. So it was busy. Plus we didn't have our Air Force guys with us. They're our experts at calling an aircraft. I mean, we know how to do it. We're not as good as them. Yeah. Like the most dangerous guy you've never heard of is a combat controller in the Air Force.
Yeah.
But we didn't bring him. We just us. So we had to call one in. They came in, and then we hopped on a big helicopter to leave. We flew in on stealth helicopters, but this is a Chinook, which is a size bigger than a school bus.
Mm-hmm.
It's got two rotors, and we had to fly that out. So that can get shot down. And then we got 90 minutes to fly out and think about it. But worrying about a missile is not going to stop it, so occupy your mind another way.
You've talked about this publicly over and over, wrote an amazing book, have a podcast, all the things. Have you ever had concern about your identity being out there, given that? And how do you manage that? We joke around in the Bachelor franchise. Like, don't say anything. We're going to get a lawsuit. How do you deal with that 24/7?
Well, I mean, it's okay. The way it worked for me was – even in the house, guys that were on the second and first floor. So, okay, my nickname was Nisro, NSRO, stood for Navy SEAL Rob O'Neill. They just called me Nisro.
Yeah.
And I'm known for telling stories and keeping morale high, jokes and shit. And every single SEAL, as soon as they found out Bin Laden was dead, they would ask who got him.
Of course.
They'd say Nisro. And they'd be like, shit, we're never going to hear the end of this. But every SEAL asked that. And so when we're flying back, other SEALs in Virginia Beach heard, and a buddy from Coronado called them, don't tell anybody, but dudes would be out and at a bar, the bartender, who got him? Well, don't say anything. But so by the time we landed back in Virginia Beach, everyone in the SEAL community knew I did it. I had guys from the White House call down and congratulations and up in New York. So my name's out there already. And, you know, I tried to keep it that way for a while. You can't get that toothpaste back in the tube. And it's better to acknowledge a threat than to put your head in the sand and think it doesn't exist. So, I mean, it's there. And I have security stuff I do, guns, dogs, cameras, but the unfortunate thing is they need to be right once. But an important lesson is to think like I'm a target, but so is every American. And there's sleeper cells here now. And not to scare everyone, but would it be easier for Al-Qaeda to come find me, a hard target, or would it be easier to go to Times Square?
Yeah.
What are they going to do? Mm-hmm. They want a big, beautiful target, not me. If they get me, great, but they're going to get in a fight too.
Yeah.
It's not fun, believe me. I mean, it's one of those things where it's,
yeah.
It's like,
has there been any attempts?
There's been a couple foiled, but I don't know how serious it could be. I don't know.
All right. So your life changes the second you pull that trigger. Mm-hmm. I have so many more questions I want to ask, but I do want to bring it back to the podcast. When do you start to see your life change publicly and then even financially with some of the accolades?
I started my process of – I wanted to get out after the raid. It was just too – it was too high profile.
Yeah.
And then August 6th, 2011, Extortion 17 was shot down. We lost 31 Americans, 17 guys from SEAL Team 6. And that's when I was like, okay, I got to get out. I've got daughters. I want to see them get married. It's time. Like a bullet needs to be right once. That's the unfortunate truth.
Yeah.
So I started the process of getting out, but I'm getting out before 20 years. So I don't have retirement. I don't have healthcare. I don't have a savings. So I got to figure it out. I actually extended for 6 months so I could go back overseas because we lost so many guys. I went back to war to backfill. And then I had till August to figure it out. And I didn't know what to do. At the time, I didn't know that like effective communication, stress management is something people want to hire. But I didn't know I had that. Like I know guys now that would rather go to combat than fill out a resume because combat makes sense. This doesn't. Wow. I don't know what shoes to wear with a tie.
Wow.
But once like I started a foundation called Special Operators Transition Foundation.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we introduced veterans to the private sector. Hmm. And I have yet to have a CEO not say that's the best employee I've ever had.
Oh, I'm sure.
Because like you come in with these attributes and we'll teach you the job.
Yeah. And you'll get it done.
So
yeah.
it was easier than I thought. Not easy, but I got into public speaking just, and I wasn't even telling the Bin Laden story. I was just talking about our success as a high performance team.
Yeah.
And it's just resonated.
Financial transparency here, like we talk, I'm just kind of like bewildered by this, but like that day that you killed Bin Laden financially, like how much money did you have in your name?
Paycheck to paycheck, so maybe $2,500 every 2 weeks.
So like maybe a $2,500 in your bank account.
Maybe, depending on how many hair dids the girls got, my daughters.
I mean,
I didn't know how much it cost to go to get a pedicure until my daughter started doing it.
But like the guy, I mean, it's the guy who literally is a Navy SEAL who gets called upon and kills Bin Laden, mm-hmm. is broke.
Yeah. I mean, these are normal dudes, Navy SEALs. When we rescued Captain Phillips, it was Good Friday, April 10th, which is my birthday in 2009. I was at my daughter's Easter tea party at her preschool.
Yeah.
And then I got a call that a guy by the name of Captain Phillips had been taken by Somali pirates. They called my team to go get him.
Mm-hmm.
I had to kiss my daughter goodbye. 15 hours and 46 minutes later, I had a full head count in the Indian Ocean. And we rescued Richard Phillips from Somali pirates, and we were still broke.
Unbelievable.
Dudes are mowing their own lawn, can't afford the mortgage. They get a call, they got
to
go.
To me, that feels like a serious, serious problem.
We don't realize it is, though. It's like everyone's struggling, so we're just going to come together. Misery loves company.
Yeah, and then you're the guy that kills Bin Laden is still trying to find ways to work and make money, mm-hmm. even after that, like just grinding out, just trying to make a couple
bucks. Well, I think about, too, the family side of it. I'm a girl dad, four daughters. My youngest daughter at the time was four, maybe, for the Bin Laden raid. I couldn't even tell anyone we were going. I just got back from war.
Yeah.
And I couldn't tell her we're leaving, whatever. And my little girl went up. I don't know what, at that age, you put into a little pink carry-on. Yeah. But she came downstairs and she put it by the door. I said, well, when you come back, we're going on a trip. My little four-year-old is like, I'm going to die next week. There's a toll that these guys, men and women, like we're just the guys that went there. There's so many women behind the scenes.
Of course.
They're the smart ones. I always tell people, I was smart enough to carry a sledgehammer and a gun. Just point me in the direction. We'll figure it out.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. Just absolutely crazy. I recently had a buddy's wedding, and they had a photo booth. And I'm not kidding. There was literally a line all night outside this photo booth. Everyone loved it. Now, what is one thing you see at every wedding or major event that you didn't see 10 years ago? It's a photo booth. Yes, like literally, they are everywhere, and people are always in line for them. Turns out, owning a photo booth business is actually one of the fastest growing ways to make great money. And Photo Booth Supply Co. makes it so easy, even if you've never owned a business before. Weddings, parties, corporate events, photo booths are a must-have for every party. And with Photo Booth Supply Co., you get the hottest photo booths, step-by-step guides, and expert one-on-one coaching to help you get it up and running fast. And get this, Photo Booth Supply Co., top earners make over six figures a year. Whether you're looking for a side hustle or ready to build a full-time business now, it's the time to start. The summer is the busiest season. For a limited time, Photo Booth Supply Co. will give you their Quick Start program for free, loaded with all the resources you need to launch your business and make money this this season. Curious how much you can make by running your own photo booth business? Check out the free profit calculator at startphotobooth.com/secrets. That's startphotobooth.com/secrets. startphotobooth.com/secrets.
So you decide to hang them up after that, but you don't even hit your full retirement.
No, no pension.
And it's still like the, and your identity's at risk. There's death threats and there's still nothing that the government is doing to
still
help.
Not.
Like not even like a little, hey, a little money out of the, do something. Like
nothing.
You did
they,
this.
They give,
that's fucking crazy.
They gave
I'm
the last
sorry,
press
that's
secretary
insane.
For the White House Secret Service detail. I have to pay for my own security.
Well, I mean, it just, yeah, especially when you start to get into politics and you start to get into like a little bit of insider trading and like what's going on. Like it's fucking crazy that like you're still paying for your, I mean, that is asinine. Have you fought that at all? Have you done anything in that?
Not fought it. I've brought it up.
Like, yeah.
I'm headed to DC soon just to talk about PTSD, all kinds of traumatic brain injury stuff with Congress just to, you know, I'm not worried about myself. I'll figure it out.
Yeah.
But yeah. The politics of it, it's tough to go paycheck to paycheck and you watch politicians who can pick stocks better than Warren Buffett.
That's what I'm saying.
Crazy.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's almost like they're really good at this. Or do they know something we don't?
Or do they know something that we don't? Uh-huh. When you're about, like, as far as CIA, you said that you, like, your identity was protected. Like, you only knew a handful of people. Is that you don't have any friends? Like, people can't know what you're doing. Everything's a secret, what you're doing for when
the
you're
missions were secret, but it was just our community.
Yeah.
Because we knew, a lot of us still knew each other from SEAL training in 1996.
Okay.
And that's just what we know. We travel all the time. We're on the road all the time. And our families just know each other.
Yeah.
So it just was like, you know, it's like even like we'd know some motorcycle gangs because we'll ride with them on Sunday. So,
yeah.
You know, but it's basically the same crew everywhere we go. And that's just all what we knew.
Understood. All right. That was in 2011. Fast forward 2025. Now an author, podcast host, public speaker. You own your own cannabis company, an entrepreneur that took 2 years to get licensed.
Yes.
Have you started to see some financial success with some of your entrepreneurial efforts?
Yeah. The biggest lesson I learned was what my fair share in taxes is.
Yeah.
Because in the Navy, they were just withholding it and you don't realize it.
Yeah.
And then once you get out, you're like, I gotta cut a check every quarter. Who's getting this? That's why I get pissed off. Because I've been to Liberia.
Yeah.
And when I went there in 2003, there was a civil war and cannibalism.
Yeah.
And to find out that millions of our tax dollars went over there so they could understand their voting rights.
Yeah.
It's like, dude, they're wearing life vests on land shooting each other. They don't care about their voting rights. Who's keeping that money?
Right.
But yeah, I mean, yeah. It's
interesting.
But I learned, you know, you can get paid for what you're worth. And a lot of my foundation came from public speaking. Like when I was told that public speakers get paid and they told me how much, I had to say, hey, is this white collar crime? No one pays that much money. It's like, no, this is just the private sector and people pay for shit here.
Yeah.
The government's not going
to
pay you.
Is it fair to say with public speaking, you made more in public speaking than you made in your entire time serving?
In the first 6 months.
Yeah. In the first 6 months.
Yeah,
unbelievable. Probably. I mean, I'm fucking glad you're in the private sector now. You deserve it.
You know what's funny too? The difference between being in the military and the private sector. I went out to my very first speech. I was in Florida. I'd never spoken publicly.
Yeah.
I didn't have any training and I got to go out. It's like 2,000 people. And I called my agent. I was like, hey, I'm a little nervous. I've been shot at, but I don't know if I'm going to faint out there. And she goes, hey, here's the key. Have 3 glasses of red wine right now. Not 2, not 4, 3. You'll be fine. And so I went out there and it was the Airline Pilots Association. And so they were captains, airline captains.
Yeah.
And they were Marines. And so I got immediately heckled for being Navy. And I'm like, this is a safe crowd.
You're good.
I got through it. I'm like, okay, I can do it.
How wild is that? For anybody out there that gets nervous about speaking, even Robert J. O'Neill, who had to literally think his life was gone, killing Osama bin Laden, had to take 3 glasses of wine.
Yeah.
You're making yourself so relatable. It's unbelievable. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about your foundation and your new cannabis company and where, if people are interested, how they can get involved with both and your book.
Right,
so
right.
The platform's yours. And like, just tell us all the things. We can start with your cannabis company.
Yeah, check out operatorcanna.com.
Okay.
And everything I do is the operator, because I'm not just saying that I'm the operator. I'm describing the life of the operator.
Mm-hmm.
And the operator is anybody. The operator is the dude who doesn't get thanked for cleaning up the trash in Manhattan at 2 in the morning, but he's cleaning it up. He's got a family too. He has to leave them. Doesn't make much money. The single mom's the best one because she is making the family run, and that's the core to anything successful.
Yep.
She's an operator. So as an operator, I will tell you what I think. You tell me what you think, and if I'm wrong, I'll admit it. And I'd like to get your input. So the Operator Canna is just, we got a couple different strains, indica, sativa, and a hybrid.
Cool.
And it's because of the post-traumatic stress, the anxiety, a lot of sleep problem. I had a lot of problems sleeping.
Okay.
And, you know, with alcohol, I wasn't getting good sleep. Mm-hmm. And I'd get in a little bit of trouble sometimes. With, sure. with cannabis, it helps me sleep, chills me out a little bit, gets rid of the noise. And so we're starting to sell it in Manhattan. We're looking to move with that. That's my primary right now, just because it's a different way and it's a good way to help even TBI, anxiety, and stress. The psychedelics, Veterans Exploring Treatment Solution, vetsolutions.org.
Okay.
And that's the group that sends veterans to Mexico to do psychedelics and or plant-based medicine. So that's Ibogaine. We were talking about that before,
yep.
which is a 5,000-year-old root from Gabon. And it just gets you into your brain stuff that you've compartmentalized or shut down. It shows it to you again. You deal with it. You come out of it, and this stuff cures addiction. It's cured alcoholism, wow. fertility problems. It cures, wow. and that's why we don't have it here legally, because it cures. And it's a wonderful, wonderful plant.
Another issue in this country, it's preventative medicine yeah. and cures.
yeah. So with that, and then my foundation, Special Operators Transition Foundation, SOTF.
Okay. .org.
And that's the one where we take veterans and put them in the private sector. And it started out as I want to help veterans get another job. But now it's like, I want to help the economy, because these are really solid people, yeah. and men and women, because yeah. there are female special operators that no one knows about. We have them.
Makes a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. I also, it feels like anyone that comes on the show has a book. And we just had a fine gentleman who had a book. I asked him the same question. I always ask this. So there's a million books out there. Obviously, this is yours. What is like the trading secret of why someone should pick this up? Like, what is the big thing that's like, this is the book you need to read, and here's why?
It's proof that it doesn't matter what you look like or where you're from, you can do anything.
Mm.
Don't put yourself in a bubble that you think just because someone's from a different part of the country, they're better than you. You can do whatever. That's it, because I didn't know how to swim, joined the Navy on a whim, on accident, and just made myself available. I mentioned it before. One of my favorite quotes is, wherever you are, be there.
Yeah.
And just make yourself available and stuff can happen. And I went from a bad relationship into the Navy on accident. I mean, even the little things, like I tell my daughters now that, because I try to join the Marine Corps, the butterfly effect is, doesn't matter if it's a good or bad decision, in 20, 30 years, the impact it has is amazing. I tell my daughters, if that Marine recruiter wasn't at Arby's at 11:30 on a Wednesday, you wouldn't be alive.
How crazy.
Because I'd be
that?
In North Carolina, not Virginia.
Yeah, how crazy.
So that,
it's just, that?
So, and again, take the shot.
Yeah.
Apply for that job. Try to get the role. Write a book. Write a play. Take the shot. And if you fail, you're going to learn. Because you learn from failure. The frustration is the learning process.
Yeah. And again, it's a very minor comparison to what you said on the ground. But like in 50 years from now, when you're on your deathbed, like mm-hmm. you're going to be like, why didn't I take that shot?
That's good too, is when you're on your deathbed, what are you going to be asking yourself? You're
not, yeah.
you're going to be talking about your family. You're going to be thinking about them.
Yeah.
Plus, exactly. if you get buried with your money, the government's going to take some of it.
That's true. At the end of the day. All right. That's the operator firing the shots that killed Osama bin Laden in my years as a SEAL team warrior. Before I wrap, it's current. It's something I have been wondering about endlessly. I'm a big true crime guy, and the assassination attempt of Donald Trump, I feel like it like came, went, no one says
no one
a
talks
word.
About it. Yeah.
And I'm wondering from your perspective, I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what's your take on what happened? You know, what do you just, you know, when you looked at like the surrounding area of it with your brain and mm-hmm. your skill set, where are things that you saw wrong? Like, just what's the overall take from Robert J. O'Neill on
inside
that?
Job. Basically what happened to
like Trump. You just said that so confidently.
Well, yeah, exactly what happened to Kennedy happened to Trump, except they missed. You know, you kill Kennedy, you kill Lee Harvey Oswald, problem solved. This kid missed. Then they killed him. He was supposed to hit Trump, kill him, it's over. You don't get that. John F. Kennedy said, I'm going to smash the CIA to 1,000 pieces because of what they did in the Bay of Pigs. Because he said, we're not invading. So they went ahead and let the Cubans go, thinking, hey, we need air support. And Kennedy said, no, I told you we're not doing that. I don't like what the agency is doing. And you heard Chuck Schumer say, don't cross the intelligence agencies. They will, 7 ways from Sunday, they'll crush you. Trump is the doge. He's going to go see what they're up to. Because and I want to be careful. Because the agency is like a shadow government that they're not elected and they have a lot of power. I think it was an inside job. I mean, there's no question. Or, okay, it's an inside job.
Like, give me the odds. The odds in your brain, like, is someone who
90-10.
90-10.
It's 90% inside job, 10% incompetence.
Interesting. And JFK?
Inside job. Like yeah. 90, you look, yeah. Look into Dulles.
Yeah.
Look into how LBJ got to where he was.
Yeah.
Look at the surgeons that said that is a, he got hit in the front, how they, yeah. his brain's gone.
Yep.
You all know, that. Little things like, look at that. Yeah. How many rows of seats were in that car Kennedy was
yeah,
in?
Yeah, yeah,
there's
yeah,
three.
Yeah,
everyone thinks there's two.
Yeah.
Did one of those dudes shoot him?
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of yeah. conspiracies.
Yeah. My last question for you is, you've been behind closed doors. You've seen so much of what the public finds out way down the road, and you've seen the public only probably see a small percentage of what the reality of the situation was. Based on like what we know today as like American citizens, when we think about all things like the craziness of like these drones and aliens and all this shit, like what percentage do you think, based on the doors and the meetings you've been in, we know versus what's actually happening? Like,
well, the issue I think is a little bit of narcissism, where people get in these backdoor rooms that I've been in at the Capitol,
yeah.
and they just think the American public is too stupid to know it.
Yeah.
Well, there's going to be martial law. They'll flip out. It's like, okay, so you're going to lock them down in their houses for 2 years?
Yeah.
And just give them money you print? This is not good. So the stuff we don't know, it's almost an arrogance where here's like when people, as a combat leader, when people say, well, it's a need to know basis and you don't need to know, I would call bullshit. It's like, I want you to know what we're doing and why all the time.
Yeah.
Because you're going to be more efficient that way.
Sure.
Why would I hide something from you?
Yeah.
And they just like doing it. It's a power thing. Narcissists and sociopaths are just attracted to Washington, D.C. Not a lot of successful businessmen go into politics.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they get that power, it's the dude that got beat up in fifth grade. Now mm-hmm. he's a congressman.
Yeah.
This worth $80 million. Yeah. Making, being worth $80 million working on a $220,000 a year, I don't know how many years you'd have to work to save that
yeah.
much. It's a lot.
Well, that's some of the problem when we talk money and I hear what, you know, mm-hmm. like the fact that you're literally on the ground killing Bin Laden and you have no money to your name. Like it's just, there's a lot of things that are asked backward. Give me a number though, percentage wise. What do you think the American public knows versus what is actually happening? Like 50%
that's a little higher than 50%, 60%, I think. 70%? Yeah, probably
60%. Okay. So it's probably about 30-40% that's yeah. tucked
There's
away.
Other stuff. I mean, you got to figure, what have we explored? 5% of the ocean?
Yeah. Oh yeah. yeah. There's some
You
shit
see
out
some
there.
Of the fish that they're finding in Mariana's Trench?
There's
like
some
those
shit out
pirate
there.
Fish
yeah. They're fucking nuts.
Down there. Yeah. That was scary enough on the surface.
That's true. All right. Good stuff. Well, we got your trading secret from the book. We've got a great episode here. We got to end with just Robert O'Neill's trading secret. All things life, the things you've been through. Can't get this from a textbook. Can't get it from a professor. You can't certainly get it from a TikTok tutorial. Just based on what you've gone through, what is one life, financial, professional, personal trading secret you can leave us with?
Never quit.
Yeah.
You're never out of the fight, no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
Again, take the shot.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm repeating myself because no, to me, it's so basic. That's it. Try again. Do it again. Wake up and do it again.
Yeah. I think I always like to say what my trading secret is. And I think my trading secret is the idea of the quitting, just the concept of like, wait till tomorrow. And then if tomorrow
that's,
you're going to quit,
it, yeah, quit tomorrow.
Because there's so many times it could be anything. Mm-hmm. It could be just like what you're doing or around a relationship or a friendship or a concept or a project. You're just like, fuck it, I'm done. But just like, just keep going. And mm-hmm. like how many times you thought in your training you were going to quit.
Every day.
You didn't quit.
Mm-hmm.
You end up being the guy. And in the history books forever that killed Osama bin Laden. Freaking unbelievable. Mr. O'Neill, where can everyone find everything you got going on?
Right now, robertjoneill.com.
Okay.
O-N-E-I-L-L. I'm rebuilding it right now, but the what's available is my personalized and signed books, because I will put your name, whatever you want, and within reason, in the inscription, put something there. The best example I have is some dude bought his friend that he worked with a birthday present. He had me sign, Jeff, you kill it selling mattresses like I kill Bin Laden.
I love it. That is,
it's a lot of fun.
Where can
personal.
People get that? They can get
RobertJOneal.com.
RobertJOneal.com. Okay, awesome. We're going to buy one of those, and we're going to give one away. So pay attention to our Social 2 Trading Secrets podcast. We're going to buy one for our listeners. And Robert, thank you so much
thank
for coming
you,
on and trading all these secrets.
Awesome. Great to be here. Thank you.
Ding, ding, ding. We are closing the bell to the Robert O'Neill episode. Oh my shit, David. Lot of action. Maybe the most action we've ever had on this podcast. There is so much to cover in such a short period of time, especially with the timing of American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden, being premiered documentary on Netflix this past week. I watched it. This interview was intense. And this interview was so intense that I think both of our shirts, especially, yeah, Brett, I showed you the picture, especially his shirt too, man, was just like covered in sweat. Like it was an intense, intense episode. If you haven't checked out the YouTube, make sure you do. But David, curious Canadian, what are you thinking?
His shirt was soaked. I need to see live footage of inside the house, the compound of that he shot Osama bin Laden in to see what his current sweat status was then, because a million times, a trillion times more intense than a Jason Tardik interview. But what timing for this. I actually watched that Netflix documentary not even knowing that we were going to release this podcast this week. So the timing was great to get the little bit of insights and areas of his life that I had no clue about, and then compiling with, you know, all the things that I watched in the documentary were it's a truly fascinating. It's one of the most fascinating things that maybe happened in our lifetime, starting with, you know, 9/11 all the way through to the killing of Osama bin Laden. And it's just to get the details of this far down the road of it taking place 25 years almost. I mean, riveting, exciting, crazy. Some sad stuff in there, but oh my God, does this guy have a resume? I had no clue, before I kick it to you, I had no clue that he was also part of the Captain Phillips rescue and the Lone Survivor rescue. Like, those two alone could make a career off of, but all three, nuts. This guy, nuts.
It's like what this guy has done in one lifetime, David. I'm just like, I try to take away some of his principles to, like, as far as just like some of the stuff he learned in Navy SEAL training and just the mental wherewithal and all these things, so I could like slowly apply them to my life. But when you hear what this man has done, you're just like, I need to do more important things.
Well, no, not even that. It's not that you need to do important things. You are doing important things. I'm doing important things. Everyone is doing relatively important things in their life. His and how he stumbled on it. He didn't even know he was on the path to do important things. And I think that's one of my biggest takeaways from his episode, is he basically said, like, you know, try everything. Like, you'll never know how it turns out, those type of things. Despite, though, my biggest takeaway from the entire thing, all the stories, all the Hell Week, all the Navy SEALs training, has nothing to do with that. This guy has no business. We should not have access to this guy to bring him onto the podcast.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Let me jump in here, because, you know, this is the big debate, and there's a lot of articles about this, and there's a lot of talk about this. Your standard protocol when you serve as a SEAL and on special missions like this and all the things is to not speak about it. I think that's like standard protocol. And you'll see in the documentary on Netflix, if you watch it, you'll see some of the people from Navy SEAL Team 6, their faces are blurred out, because like that is kind of, that's what you're supposed to technically by like principle, I guess, and history do. And I think, David, real quick, I think what I've heard buzz is that Rob O'Neill has gotten ostracized from a little bit from some of his peers and his group because he has gone out there and spoke a lot about this. But from my vantage point, like you heard me in this episode, when a man of this caliber has served the way he has and has done for his country what he has, the idea that he could just be like left broke and, you know, on your own and not be able to use any of this experience and storytelling for empowerment and inspiration and education is, in my opinion, ludicrous. So I think it's, I commend him for saying, hey, like if I'm kind of stuck between a rock and a hard place here, I'm going to use the experience that I've had to leverage it appropriately to take care of me and my family. Because I, for so long, took care of my country and put my family's entire future from the perspective of parenting and guidance and everything at risk for majority of their life.
It's a good take and it's good perspective. And I'm glad that you caught me before I went on a rant, because I was probably going to go on a pretty electric rant there. But it is a good catch 22. It is the ultimate sacrifice of, you know, signing up to serve your country. And he did serve his country in every way that he was asked to. And through that, you're not doing it for fame and you're not doing it for fortune. You're doing it for the purpose of what the military serves in terms of protecting the country. So you're right. Like, you sign up for that. So I guess you, like, in my opinion, it's like, how does this guy not have a statue? How is this guy not like talked about amongst, you know, presidents and things like that, like with the importance of roles that he's played in some of the most, you know, pivotal moments in the history of the military and the country's safety. And here he is on our podcast. And here he is talking about how he doesn't get a pension. And here he is talking about how he is almost treated like a in a corporate America salesperson who doesn't meet their Q1 numbers. And they're like, you know, kicked out of the company. And he's finding ways to make revenue and he's finding ways to make a living. That to me was the overall, like, once you peel back all the like the really like edgier seat stuff. When the episode hit end, I was just like, this guy's like, he's still grinding to make it all
grinding.
Work. To say he made more in 6 months of speaking than he did in his whole life of serving the country. I guess it goes back to what you sign up for, though. I guess it goes back to what you're not signing up for the military for fame or fortune. That's why I think on all these holidays and moments, we do get to honor troops and military. We you know, even more so, like you have to, like, it's the ultimate sacrifice, even if you're legendary status.
I mean, I agree. And there's so many things I think to take away from this episode. I know you're talking about like some of your big takeaways, but to me, this episode almost felt like a book. Like when we were talking about Navy SEAL training, so much to take away. When we were talking about like the actual sniper versus the guy who's like doing the lookout and stuff, and how he talked about how like the smallest things control your heart rate, how you eat, what you do, how you're breathing, and the impact of that. It's fascinating to me. But the one thing, you know, that I think be burned in my brain forever is when I'm watching the documentary and then hearing the story. And he's talking about how they get on the chopper. And when they're on the chopper, once they pass in Afghanistan, they're clear when they're flying. But once they go into Pakistan for this mission, they are now in enemy territory and they could easily get shot down. And so what he started to do was count. And he started to go 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, just to like keep his mind active. And he got to like 547 and he stopped. And he said, no, freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward and freedom will be defended. Freedom itself was attacked this morning by a faceless coward and freedom will be defended, which was part of George W. Bush's speech after 9/11. And he's like, I just kept repeating that to myself over and over and over because that was my reminder of why I'm here, what I'm doing, and the impact that we're going to have. And when they're telling the story and he's telling it here and on the documentary and they're leaving, like mission complete and they're leaving, they have 90 minutes to get after a helicopter literally just completely crashed.
Crazy.
Twitter's going all crazy about it. They're trying to literally not let one person see Twitter's going crazy. They have the person that's on the ground for them that's trying to keep the civilians at bay. And they now have to get out of Pakistan knowing that they can get shot down at any moment, even after mission was complete. It's just correct. I mean, I'm watching this documentary and I'm listening back to this episode and my heart is pumping out of my chest. I just can't imagine living it.
It is, and on the documentary, they said that, so what he didn't talk about in the episode and what they talked about in the documentary is they got built because they practiced for so long this mission, kind of like he was talking about the free throws, like repetition. They built the most insane structure to replicate the compound, and because they knew what the exterior was like, they didn't know what the interior was like, and so they had these like maneuverable ways to change walls, and they basically went through every single way it could have been set up, and they practiced hundreds and thousands of times. They went in there, they executed the mission, and then they had to get all the data. He said on the documentary that they were on the ground for way longer than they ever anticipated.
45 minutes. And they're supposed to be there for 30 to 32 minutes, but they're there for 45 minutes, yeah.
And then when you hear him talk about the second chopper that comes in was the size of a school bus, it's just like I can't even imagine. I can't even fathom that. That all happened, and the craziest part about the doc is when they talk about the lengths that they went and the different strategies they used over 10 years to track down Osama bin Laden. Just an absolute surreal opportunity that we get to have him on the podcast while this is the number two trending show on all of Netflix. People, when I like, we've been doing the podcast for 4 years. My wife, I turned to her today and showed her the video of who we were podcasting. And she saw his face because we just watched the doc. She was on the edge of her seat, excited to listen to it. So if you have listened to it or have seen the doc, listen to this. If you're listening to this and haven't seen the doc, either way, you're going to get 10x more out of it, and they're both phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, perfectly said. An absolute honor to be able to interview someone at this capacity and to learn so much about the inner workings. David, I mean, I feel like I don't want to miss kind of some of the Navy SEAL training. I feel like we have to talk a little bit about that. Like, either, you know, just being tied up and thrown into water and just be like, don't die. Like, literally, that's their, and you have to find a way not to die. Tied up, hands behind their back, legs tied, thrown into water, learning how to bob until they don't die. And just the one other thing I want to say that just blew me away too was this concept of like, how he said the strongest guy or the one that always acted the toughest was always the first one out, and how every day he wanted to quit. Every day he planned on quitting, but he was just like, I'll quit tomorrow morning. That's one for sure. Like when you're having a really hard day, things just aren't going your way. When you're really struggling, just being like, you know, just being able to be like, I'll get through today. I'll get through today. I'll get through today. Just get through today. Just get through the next hour, you know?
I love that concept of small goals he talked about. He said he really got good at small goals instead of long goals, because small goals were that exact mindset. To get through Hell Week, you can't think about the end of Hell Week. You got to think about getting across that finish line through this task, running and getting this food. I thought that was incredible. I also thought, I mean, I could talk about all the things that I couldn't do in Hell Week, which is pretty much all of them. I do love what he talked about how calm is contagious. How I loved that. And the one thing, and I've caught myself doing this multiple times today, is he said stress is a choice. And the way that he talked about it was so true. And I found myself starting to stress about things. And I was like, I'm choosing to build this up in my brain that it's something that it probably isn't. And especially if it's something that I can't control, it's gone. If I can't control it, I ain't stressing about it. If I can control it, do something about it so that you're not thinking about it and stressing about it, right? Like that's, you know, that I think those two things, calm is contagious and stress is a choice. And then the last thing I'll say is I just
and panic is contagious. Like the opposite. Yeah. Remember we talked about panic. It's like one person panics about something, we all panic, you know? So I think it's interesting to hear that, yeah, calm is contagious, but so is panic. And like we have a decision. And that's why it's important to surround yourself around the right people, right?
I loved his analogy where he's like, yeah, you ever seen an airplane board? Like someone zone five tries to
five
zone
goes
one.
Zone one.
Panic. And then when you think about like panic and calmness being contagious, it's like think of like a chaotic boarding situation. And like the airline attendant who's like calm, and it's like that person's like keeping this going, or airline attendant who's like panicking and yelling at people. It's like this just got off the rails. So I thought those are great. I mean, he says wherever you are, be there and make yourself available. Those are great. Like those are great. Relative, doesn't matter who's listening in your job, in your opportunity, in your life. Like make yourself available, and wherever you are, just be there. Just focus on being there, being present. I thought those were amazing, amazing takeaways.
Yeah. Can't say enough good things about this episode. I feel honored that we had the opportunity to, you know, interview Rob. I was sitting there today. I binged the documentary, and on episode 3, the last episode, I'm sitting there just sobbing in tears, you know. And after that, to be like, wow, we got to sit down with someone who had the largest role in killing this person who is like just pure evil in every form. I don't know. It was like a little bone chilling, a little surreal moment. Yeah. And for anyone out there that serves or anyone that knows anyone that serves, thank God we have those people. Thank God that we have them to give us the freedoms to do what we do day in and day out. So truly, a whole different ball game this episode, man. Whole different ball game.
A whole different ball game is right. And the last thing I'll say too is like seeing the human being element behind the shooter was really, really interesting too, about his family life, his four daughters, and even the reflections that he's having 7 to 8 years later about, you know, killing became normal and now he's time has passed and reflecting on you know, the situations that he found himself in and people that he's killed and, you know, maybe asking himself, how did they view me? Was I the bad guy? Was he the bad guy? Really, really bone chilling stuff. And, you know, just to hear about where he's at and how he thinks about things. And, you know, he was parts of the most confidential missions ever, and he still has his own questions about, you know, big picture stuff. So some crazy sound bites, some crazy experiences, some crazy stories. But like you said, at the end of the day, 400 guests we've had on, what a surreal guest to have on the podcast at the timing of when he came on.
And even the elements of the PTSD, you know, like like you said, just about all the moving factors of that, the impact that has on those that serve, and the attention that we all need to give it, right? And the resources that are necessary for that attention. Just intense. I will say that's probably one of the harder questions I've ever had to ask of 200 plus episodes. That was a hard one. Just like asking him like about the idea of killing someone and like how does that sit? And that was, I don't know, it's just a wild moment.
Seems like a really good guy. And, you know, a complete catch 22 situation of someone who, you know, on one hand, I think my gut says this guy should be treated like royalty. And then on the other hand, you talk about how he could be ostracized from, like, you know, the SEAL community and understanding what they sign up for and how they do things and how they protect. It's a catch 22 episode. Everyone who's going to listen to this is going to have their views and opinions, and it's going to hit them in different ways. So, crazy world we live in, like you said.
I agree. It's a catch 22. You're going to have a lot of different opinions out there. I do think the one opinion we can all share here is thank God, that people were put on this planet, specifically in the United States, like Rob O'Neill, to protect us and to serve us and to put our freedoms and our country at the forefront of their interests. And thank God we have people like that to do what he has done and the way he's served and all of it.
And all of the military and intelligence to be able to be so dedicated to set these soldiers up for success. They are prepared. They are dialed in. So overall, great episode. Surreal episode. Hope everyone enjoyed it.
Yeah, and I would just end with this. If you haven't seen American Manhunt, Osama bin Laden, go check it out. Like, they show you the war rooms of, like, the decisions that Barack Obama had to make during his presidency, and the thought process and the way people voted on it. And, you know, they're like live footage of them watching the mission happen. And, oh, just an absolutely unbelievable documentary. Check it out. Rob, thank you for being on the podcast. David, great little recap here. An intense episode, educational, informational, and certainly an inspiring one. And David, you got anything else?
No, I don't. We're good to go.
We're good to go. Thank you for tuning into another episode of Trading Secrets, one you can't afford to miss.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No.